Hi, I'm Matt Brennan, TV editor for the Los Angeles Times.
And I'm Kareem Maddox, podcast host, producer, and professional basketball player.
We're the hosts of Binge Sesh, a new podcast from the LA Times. Every season, Binge Sesh dives deep on one TV series and the real-life stories behind it, on and offset.
Everyone knows who you are if you're on the Lakers, especially at that time period. Those guys were rock stars. People were throwing themselves at them.
This season, we take on Winning Time, HBO's highly anticipated series about the Showtime Lakers, one of sport's most unforgettable dynasties.
Everything you see in the NBA today, when you go to an NBA game today and you see dance troupes, crazy halftime entertainment, celebrities courtside, that's all the Showtime Lakers.
Each week, we'll bring you stories from the locker room, the soundstage, and the Times archives as we explore how Showtime transformed the NBA and American culture.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
On a cold morning in Indianapolis, Tony Caritzis woke up, loaded his shotgun, and drove to his bank. He wasn't there to steal anything. He was there to take his life back. American Hostage tells the true story of one man who channeled the rage of a nation and took justice into his own hands. Follow American Hostage wherever you get your podcasts, or you can binge all 8 episodes right now on Amazon Music.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1144. Well, it has been a minute since I posted an episode. This was supposed to go up a few weeks back. The baby that we were expecting was due around mid-February, and she decided to come out a little bit early at the end of January. We named her Dimity, D-I-M-I-T-Y, Hurst Hardwick. So she's got the hyphenated last name. And Leah posted something on Instagram that kind of explains the origin of the meaning of the name. But it's been just amazing. It is absolutely amazing. Both the baby and Lydia are doing great. She's incredible. And literally every day it is just magical to watch a person like form and their personality form. And it's like, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago, I was like, oh my God, I think she just noticed her own hand for the first time. It is absolutely amazing. And we are loving it. So I apologize. I know there's been a lot of inconsistency with posting lately. We were trying to get the nursery ready. There were a lot of renovations to make that happen. And also just a ton of stuff. It turns out there's a lot of stuff to do before the arrival of a new tiny human. And also, on top of that, I think I'm not ready yet to continue posting regularly. I think it's better just to take this opportunity to say that I'm gonna post this episode and then continue to not post for a bit as part of a more official parental leave. Things are starting to get busy again work-wise, so I just wanna make sure that I'm really mindful to protect my time just so that I can focus on the baby, focus on Lydia, who had a C-section, so she's also recovering as well. So maybe don't unsubscribe. How about that? And then, you know, I'll squeak out episodes when I can. If you know anything about me, you probably know that I feel horrible that I can't do everything all at once. And I just so apologize. I hate letting people down. I don't mean to disappoint you if you're a new listener or a longtime listener or whatever. I really want to be as present as I can as a parent and also as a partner. So thank you for understanding. I'm sorry for taking a little break. I can't say when exactly I'll resume, but hopefully soon. So that's all that. But let's talk about this episode. It's Al Madrigal, who is an old comedy friend of mine. Al is a great stand-up, and we actually complain a lot in this episode about like the stuff that we would do pre-pandemic in terms of like the travel and all the stuff that surrounds the stand-up. And it occurred to me, like, oh my God, I'm complaining a lot about doing stand-up, but I actually am going to do stand-up again this fall. So I'm not quitting stand-up, but not having had to be on an airplane every weekend it just made me realize, like, wow, that was a lot of travel and a lot of energy in that direction. But yes, so I'll be performing again in the fall on the road. I'm not sure. Doesn't sound like Al's really going to tour much anymore, but he's really funny. But he's got so many amazing things going on. I mean, Al has Morbius is coming out. It was supposed to actually come out a few weeks back, but then just because of pandemic stuff, it got pushed to April 1st. And Morbius is the Sony Marvel vampire story with Jared Leto. And Al is in it, and it looks awesome. And then also, Al has released a comic book series called Primos, which is available now wherever you get comics. And this was just such a great catch-up. I mean, again, I love doing the podcast. I love that, you know, with friends that I haven't talked to for a while, it's like, oh, we catch up, and then that happens just to be a podcast episode. And so this was recorded in December, so the baby actually hadn't been born yet. So that's kind of the, just to give you the timestamp on that. So again, so sorry for the inconsistency with the posting the last couple months. Whether you're a longtime listener to the podcast or a newer listener to the podcast, just know that I really, really, really appreciate your patience and understanding. And, you know, we've never had a baby before, so we're just, you know, we're navigating it as best we can. And as parents, we really just want to be as present as possible and focused on the baby as possible, because it really does. Everyone always says, like, it moves so fast, and it really does, even in just a few weeks, just watching how much she's grown and how much her awareness has come online and everything, you know? I just want to be as around as and present as much as possible to not miss any of it. So I really, really, really appreciate your understanding. And thank you so, 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 so much. And now here is the ID10T podcast number 1144 before we take an official parental break, with episodes posting when we can, with Al Madrigal as we roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Recording in progress.
Hello? Oh, no. Oh, this is exactly what I feared. Al Madrigal's been taken over by robots.
I'm just going to unplug this. Now you can hear me.
Was that that was a special microphone.
This was supposed to, I've actually used this successfully so many times, and the last couple times I've tried to use it on Zoom, it just hasn't worked at all. So,
Well, look, you sounded like a cool robot. So,
right, that's it.
I think maybe it's a great. Al Madrigal's become a supervillain. He's like got struck by lightning while like putting in a Wi-Fi range extender. It gave him a computer brain. Now he is just a robot. He's a robot.
That's a super cool like origin story. Or he just got throat cancer because he smoked a lot in college.
Now that's a much sadder. Well, that's like when you go back and you look at all of the, like, you know, Peter Parker got bitten by a radioactive spider. Superpowers or deadly terminal disease? Or he just dies instantly. I mean, you know. So if you really kind of break down a lot of the origin stories, especially those early days when they were so fascinated by radioactivity, it's like, no, just instant death. Like there, or a long, drawn out, horrible death, but not superpowers.
I was in, for some reason, I was doing stand up on the road, and it was the Crystal Skull had come out. So we could probably find out. This is like one of my, I hated the road so much. And it was the Coconut Grove Improv, which was one of like the worst improvs ever. And Thursday night, nothing to do afterwards. I'm not going to go into Miami or do anything like that. I'm just really bored. So there's a movie theater attached to the comedy, you know, right near the comedy club. So I went and saw Indiana Jones, Crystal Skull. And 10 minutes in, he has to get into a refrigerator because there is like he's at a they're testing an atom bomb. And I remember there was a kid behind me. He goes, "Oh, that's so fake! I can't believe he didn't die." Like, and I'm like, first of all, it's Indiana Jones.
He's probably not going to die. They probably it'd be probably weird to kill him 10 minutes in. But what a really strong choice to make to kill the lead character of a major franchise 10 minutes into a
it would have made for a better movie.
You've already
congratulations the baby. Have you made this baby announcement? Should I be talking about
the Yeah. We made the baby announcement. The baby is 7 weeks away, and by the time this podcast posts, it'll be even closer. So we're way into it, and I don't know why, but for some reason, at numerous times throughout the pregnancy, your voice has popped into my head doing a bit that I saw you do at the Improv probably maybe 12 years. I don't even remember when, but it might have been – you might have been a new dad at that point. But it was something like, yeah, you guys got to get yourself one of these babies. I don't know. I just like to hear your voice doing this bit about
new
having
baby,
a baby.
Old baby. Yeah, I have a new baby and my – I think the old baby hates the new baby. I just will just know that the babies I was talking about are now 19 and 15 and almost 16. So,
oh God, yeah. I feel remarkably old and also powerless at the passage of time.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it's about to turn 16. I'm teaching that baby how to drive unsuccessfully. we have this old, for my son, I got him this old Toyota Land Cruiser. It's super cool. It's a 1988 Toyota Land Cruiser.
Awesome.
Car that I always wanted. And I put my daughter in that. And I'm like, oh, I got to sell this thing because you need a backup camera and lane change. I want the car that automatically corrects your poor driving because she's not going to be the one to drive the death machine.
You know what this makes me think about is I constantly complain at autocorrect, like, fuck, that's not the word I wanted, or why did you think I meant this word? But then if you ever type without autocorrect, you're like, oh, I'm an oaf, and I can't spell anything, and I really miss the, basically the text equivalent of the inflatable bumpers in the gutters, you know, in the bowling lane. And so I feel like that now we're just so accustomed to having bumpers on everything.
Why not take the help? Like, and I grew up in San Francisco. I never learned how to drive a stick because we just didn't have them. The hills were so, I knew people who did. And, you know, I know my dad did at one point, but when automatics like really came out, it's like, they're shifting for you. Why are we
still in this charade that we have to drive the old fashioned? I can't imagine like coming down Lombard Street in a stick. I just feel like, oh, well, you'll just die because that's horrifying.
The same thing is with like, I got the Tesla, and my wife is just terrified about the self-driving. I think it's one of the best things that's ever happened to me. I got a million things going. I'm like, I know you shouldn't be doing it. I'm like barely holding on to the steering wheel and letting it just drive for me as much as possible. I shouldn't be driving.
I'm not ready for that yet. I'm just not ready for it. I just, you know, technology is too fallible and it's still, you know, like it's to a degree, it's still like befriending a bear. It's like, yeah, the bear might be cool to you, but it also might rip your guts out, you know? And I sort of feel like that's technology. Like it, at the end of the day, it's still just technology. It's still a soulless machine trying to approximate human behavior and decisions. And it's going to not be right some of the time.
I think it's also what we just sort of walked into was people that have become successful and still trying to do stand-up comedy. Like my wife hates the self-driving car, but I like it's just like doing observational material.
super rich. I don't know. Yeah, Al, you've been in one of these, what are they, grocery stores? You've been in one of these grocery stores lately? God, I tried to go in there the other day. I don't know what's going on. What am I, Captain Crunch? What am I?
I did a gig for the NFL owners, and they were all billionaires. And I joked when I was up there, I'm like, what could you guys relate to? Don't you hate it when your chef gets in a fight with your pilot? Don't you hate that? At the same time, I think it was it? Paul Allen had just driven, this is Super Bowl 50, when the Denver Broncos played the Carolina Panthers, and they were at the new Santa Clara Stadium. And Paul Allen wasn't there because his yacht crashed into a protected reef. I said that, don't you hate when that happens? All right, guys? Get that bitch.
And also, by the way, you know, like, the type of yacht that Paul Allen has is really like a cruise ship. Like, it's probably not, isn't it? Doesn't he have like one of the, isn't it like the record for like, oh, it's not even like a yacht anymore. It's like it's not quite an aircraft carrier, but it's even beyond what you would picture a yacht being.
I'm sure. And now Jeff Bezos has that yacht. Did you see that article where he has the companion yacht that goes along with it that has a helipad?
That's so sweet. I bet they have friendship bracelets and that's like yacht buddies.
But it is akin. It's like that massive tour bus RV, like towing a Jeep. Like, it's right? Yeah, I just want to splinter off and get it.
You know, we're just going to spend this whole time doing bits. I haven't been on stage in almost 2 years. Like, I didn't. You're done?
Yeah. I might have one more album in me, but I have a ton of rationale for me bowing out. I first of all, I hate The Road. There's so many things I hate. I love stand up. I hate what it's become. Like, to be successful, I feel like you have to be live tweeting your breakfast.
I always feel like I'm not, like, I see other comedians who we know that do a great job of being on top of everything, and I'm so exhausted anymore. And I say this as someone who, clearly I'm just getting old, but as someone who was like a fervent early adopter of technology and wanted to, you know, was like, oh yeah, I really want to do all of it. And now I'm just like, God, I just don't have the energy anymore. And I don't care. And I don't, like, I've definitely become old man-ish about it. And I feel the same way with you. It's like, I just can't. And no matter how many times you post about something, people aren't going to see it because it's just so crowded and no one cares. And it just, yeah, I 1,000% feel the same thing.
Yeah, where I think about taking out my phone and recording something, I go, no, this is just for me. Like, I'll.
I have this conversation all the time where my wife will go, you love doing stand-up. And I go, yes, I love being on stage for that hour and 15 minutes, but everything around it is a lot. Like, it's, especially now, like, you know, with travel and so it just feels like there's so many hours of other things that kind of eclipse the hour of time that you get to do the thing that you absolutely love.
We did it. Like, this, you experienced like every level of success with it. You got to do all that open mic fun stuff. You got to do the community. I'd see you, like we said, I could see you at the improv. We got that fun, like, hang, you know, like we did all of that. I hung out at the Comedy Store. I did New York stand-up. I did, you know, post Daily Show. Me and Hodgman would go out, and it was the time of my life. Like, I really do. Like, we got to do big theaters, like post, like the combined correspondence. And so sometimes it was like me, Hodgman, you know, who else would go? Like, Kristen Schaal would go, and it was just
wow,
a blast. And so it's like we did that, and I'm good. Like,
I totally understand. And I've surprisingly been okay with not performing the entire pandemic. Like, I felt like, okay, that kind of desire just sort of went to sleep a little bit. Maybe I'm a little more, you know, like, comedic in conversations than I used to be, because I still have that gene. But in terms of like, I got to be on stage every night, like, I don't feel that anymore.
So I got to tell you, the funniest thing is we booked this. And then coincidentally, I turn on The Wall, and I was like, what's this show? And I thought, I was like, is this Plinko? Are they just playing big Plinko? And then I swear to God, I'm crying. I'm almost in tears watching the two Navy officers in love.
I love them.
I was like, what is this show? It's not so wonderful. Yeah,
I know. I know that the show like has this really great way of bringing contestants on, and every single one of them, you're like, God damn it, this is what people are supposed to be like. Like this is how the world could be. You know, like it
going into it completely blind was hilarious. Then I'm like,
what is this?
Even like halfway, no, she's like, what? So they're gonna drop that thing and answer a bunch of questions, and then they're gonna figure out where it goes, and you know, and then they're sort of walking you through. Whoever the producers of that are great because they got these guys pouring their hearts out to each other. And I was just, again, just shocked that this was the show. I did not expect it. It just really caught me off guard.
It caught me off guard when they initially asked me to do it. I was like, oh, I don't know. I can't really picture what you're talking about when they pitched me the show. And they said, come and play it in our offices. And I did. And I immediately was like, oh, I get this. This is really fun. You're dropping a ball down, there's action, there's a strategy element, there's a trivia element, it's super fun. What I was totally unprepared for was what you said as a viewer. We started taping the first episode and I was like gut-wrenched at how much I loved the people who were on the show and their story and who they were. And then I realized like, oh, it feels kind of like a podcast to me. I'm getting to know these people and they're great. And in the midst of it, hopefully I can, you know, they can walk away with a bunch of NBC's money. So it totally snuck up on me too. It really did.
Speaking of podcasting, you also did something that I will, you know, you get favors for life, for the rest of your life from me, not that you'll need to call on them, but you were so nice. My son, and this is back when he was like a sophomore in high school, started the podcast club and you were his first interview. And like, I remember Louis Anderson was leaving. So, you know, and this is partially because to get into any college, I told him my son was a great, you see where I'm going with this, but he was a great little athlete, but he was like, you know, he's 5'9". He went to a school where, you know, somebody could do the same thing on the basketball team as him. And he's 6'5". So you can't compete. So he's always looking for his thing and, you know, started the podcast club. And then we came up with a podcast idea called High School Time Machine.
Yep.
And he came in to interview you with his buddy Jack, and you were delightful. So
oh, my God. It was such an honor because it sort of feels like, oh, my God, this is exactly what I would have done if podcasting was what it was when I was in high school. Of course I would have been in a podcasting. Like I just saw a window into, and I just so wanted to encourage, like, yes, this is awesome. Keep doing what you're doing. This is cool. Someday this is all going to pay off in a, you know, in a wonderful way. And you should keep doing it. It's great.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. But yeah, it's like it's led to me being involved in this business. I've always sort of taken them around to if I'm on a TV show, I'm like, let me go introduce you to the prop guy. They're great. Hey, well, why don't you look over here and just meet all the people in that make up this 120 person crew that's making this thing, because there's so many amazing jobs that people are just unaware of. I had no idea that even when I got into stand up, the business behind, you know, or, you know, anything that I could do creatively, I just had no clue how many jobs that existed. So it's sort of cool to be able to show people that I definitely want to do that on a larger scale. I'm trying to figure that out. But yeah, there's no, because there's another thing is there's no Latinos in show business at all. Like, I'm not sure if you've seen any of like the UCLA studies or the Annenberg studies.
No.
Oh my God, it's horrible. It really is bad. That's what led to me to doing this comic book. But
Primos?
Yeah, Primos. 20% of the population, 5% of the characters on TV. And in movies, I think it's even worse. Like, they did this big study, and of the, you know, female stars in movies, it was like just J-Lo and Cameron Diaz.
But this is what's so interesting about, you know, we start our career paths and, you know, at first I feel like we're very focused on ourselves and what, you know, like, oh, I, you know, you want to do things for yourself. And then maybe it's because you become a parent. Maybe it's because you start to get older. But it's so interesting to watch you kind of pull away from something, which is, you know, like, stand-up is a little bit of an ego pursuit. Of course it is. It feels good, you know, but it's just us. To you then saying, like, you know, I want to make the world a better place in this way. I want to make it more accessible in this way. I want to make the business better. Like, it's just such a great, I don't know, it's just, it's fun to watch us all grow up and have these realizations and you realizing that you can make a difference. You can, you know, work to change things and do everything you can to make things better.
Absolutely. That feels great. And also, stand-up is a full-on ego pursuit. Like, that is just like you walk on stage and people lose their minds. If you were to walk up at the Comedy Store and they go, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special guest. Chris Hardwick is here. Then people would go nuts.
And that's that would feel very good.
Very good. Like that. And then, I mean, you could just, you keep chasing that. Like, there's a reason why the Rolling Stones keep getting up on stage. They certainly don't need to. But
no, but like, what else? But I also understand, like, but what else are they going to do? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, when people, I think people overestimate the idea of like, you could just go sit on a beach somewhere. It's like, yeah, that's fun for 10 minutes. But then if they're in the, you know, if they've conditioned themselves to need to keep moving, I mean, honestly, if they just quit, they would probably just wither, you know, like they probably just need that to stay alive.
You do need that to stay alive. You need to make plans. So I totally get that. Yeah, it's like and have some goals. My dad had cancer. And that's the first thing the doctor told him, was like, make plans. Like, you really just carve some stuff out that you want to do. And, make sure you get to it. And to like, so he made this big long list and then really just marched through it. So, and then when the list was done, he finished everything. It's like, no more, gone. Oh, no, but I think that kept him alive. I think he made a goal of wanting to see my brother's daughter born. And that was his last thing. And I swear it was crazy. That's exactly what happened. I didn't mean to make the return this. It got really sad all of a sudden.
It's a podcast, Al. It can be funny and dippy and sad and all of those things. But it's also very, it's also just a good, and maybe I'm just sort of at that point in my life where it's like, yeah, I guess, you know, you don't live forever, you know, but the idea of like just not taking those, not taking every day, not taking the days for granted and just making sure that you're not constantly deferring something into this bin where it just kind of vaporizes because you just feel like time is endless.
But comedy allows us to have this big, fun, weird, eclectic career and you could do so many, spin so many things off of it. I feel like just to do pure stand-up, like that's certainly a choice, but there's so many fun other things that you can do. Like I really enjoy being a small business owner, you know, and I really enjoy you know, helping other comics creatively, you know, start shows, podcasts, as a producer. Like there's, you know, again, acting is fantastic. I love acting and writing as well. So there's like you can't do it all. It is hard to just
do stand up and just maintain that lifestyle because you have to, it kind of never stops. And I think it's great to be able to, I love doing other things too, but I love being able to go do stand up, you know, when I can, but also like I feel like I could never be a comedian who does like 45 weeks a year on the road. I never wanted to be that before. And I certainly don't now, especially with a baby on the way. Like, I don't want to be gone. I don't want to be gone that much at all. You know, and that's what it requires.
Yeah. That was the big thing that changed for me as I was doing consistent stand up. I did a show. It was a short-lived Jimmy Carr show called The Fix on Netflix.
Netflix, yeah.
And then DL was my partner, who's a great guy, DL Hewley. And he was telling me how he was on the road so much he didn't even see his kids grow up. And so now I have this 14-year-old, you know, at the time, or 13-year-old, and I know she's going to be driving. That's the thing that happens. Like, I watched my son drive away as a 16-year-old, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm never seeing him again.
He's just realized, oh, I can just drive this anywhere. I don't need
to.
Yeah.
Just a crash around the corner. But once they get cars, like, they're out. So I just were like, I'll maximize this time. I wish I had all the other time that I was on the road back. You know, I certainly would have spent more time at home.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely trying to figure out the balance, and it's really hard because stand-up is one of those things that's very difficult to balance because of how much, even like you're saying, like, you know, the friends that we have that are so committed to just nonstop posting, it's like there's so much around it. Whether it be you have to be a fierce marketer, you have to just be a content machine now. I was even trying to figure out, I Googled the other day, like, are albums obsolete? Like, does it even make any sense anymore? Especially because with podcasts, like, you know, we've conditioned, like, we have this disposable content that gets posted weekly or however often it gets posted. It used to be the comedy album was like the culmination of like, this is what I've done for the last 2 years. And now it just feels so much like, eh, it's great, next, you know. And so, like, is an album, does it even really mean anything anymore? I don't know. I'm really kind of having an existential crisis with it. Music album, comedy album, whatever.
Yeah, I think that's why you could see comedians doing what like Rihanna does or Jay-Z does. It's like, oh, you just put out singles. Like, we
right.
put out singles, and that would be cool. But it's like, I don't know. I, as somebody that, you know, we have a record company at All Things Comedy, and so we certainly haven't figured it out because it's like what we've been told is just from the record company standpoint, it's a volume business, and you're only going to do a record if you want like a Grammy nomination at some point. And so that's why you see all the Netflix special people turn their audio from their special into albums just so they can make a Grammy play. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, as somebody, like, I'd rather listen to a podcast when I get in the car, you know, and sometimes I'll flipped on, Arch Barker's album for my son, because I'm like, I started with this guy in San Francisco. He's hilarious. You should know who he is. And so we listened to a lot of Arch. But, you know, I dug up a comedy album from like 2018 or something. It was, you know, in Australia. Like, you could tell it was going over his head a little bit, you know, in terms of like all the Australian references. And I'm like, all right, maybe not this one.
Okay, someday we'll go to Australia. We'll revisit this.
Yeah, and you know, Brisbane, you know, but you know, again, like, I just don't know what I feel like we have. It's such, people have such an insatiable thirst for content.
Yeah,
that if it is worth it for somebody to put out an album, I just know that, you know, the people that seem to be successful are just relentlessly posting. And I just don't have the time for it.
That's just a job that I'm just not super interested in. Like, because it to be in the momentum of it is really stressful. I got to post. I didn't put, you know, it's like you put this unnecessary stress on yourself that, you know, if you don't post for a week or 2 days, then it's like, it's all going to fall apart. And I just think it's a big scam. Like, it doesn't, it's, you know, like, it's fine if you don't. Yeah. I just don't know. I feel like I would rather feel calm and balance rather than being able to say like, oh, I sold out this big venue, but everything that I had to do to get there just like ate me alive inside. I don't know if it's worth it.
No, I think some people just want to be popular to be popular, and other people want or become popular because they're talented. And so the popular for popular's sake, people are just like drowning out anybody with that. You know, it's just, they're constantly, again, it's not about, it becomes less and less about talent and more about just outrageousness and stunts. Like, it's just,
I just noticed when Mike Nesmith from the Monkees just passed away, and you know, all these articles came out. Oh, he, you know, and I'm a big Monkees fan, and there was stuff that I didn't. There was music of Mike Nesmith that I didn't even know, and I felt bad for not knowing. And then I also felt bad because I would see like, oh, Mike Nesmith may have actually pioneered the country rock movement. And I sort of felt like, you could have told him that when he was alive, you know? Like, why did he have to die before everyone was like, oh, this guy was a genius? Like, 2 weeks ago, you could have told him that. You know what I mean? Like, it just, I don't know. So, in a way, it sort of feels like you can't control any of that external stuff anyway, the popularity contest, you know, who's going to be popular, who's not, who's going to sell X number of tickets, who's not. So, how do you just... Maybe you just kind of focus on what you like to do, and then whatever happens with that happens with that. I just don't know if it's worth chasing it so hard.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem worth it at all. Like, it really doesn't. Like, there's, again, like, I found myself, you know, thinking about, and this is years and years ago, but it's like, okay, on my deathbed, you know, and you're like, who are you going to have around you? And it's one of those things, it's like, yeah, it's not your social media manager.
It'll be really fun if we do a jump cut right before you die. We could just like switch your outfit really fast. That'd be a great TikTok. No, I don't.
I'm going to, just hang out. I really am old man. I started this thing as an old man. Like, I got into it super late. You know, I was working for my parents' family business and then started doing stand-up in San Francisco at 28 and then actually left the company. And this is probably around the time that we're meeting when I come down, like 2004, 2002, I think I start coming down. 2003, I get a gig. And then me and my 1-year-old and wife moved down to LA from San Francisco in 2003. So like I started being too old for this shit.
I always felt the same. I did stand up a little in college, but not really full time until I was like 27. I'm like, fuck, why'd I wait so long? But you know, it just worked out the way it worked out, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, met my wife doing stand up, met all my best friends doing stand up. And certainly, again, you know, I just had the coolest sort of stand-up experience. It's like, I don't want to mess with that either. Like, you know, I was Hedberg's opener. I got to open for Chappelle. I went on the road with Tosh, who I think is a really underrated stand-up comedian. Daniel Tosh, I will put up against most comics. I really will. And I'm a huge stand-up comedy fan. I think Daniel Tosh is one of the best comics out there. I swear to you. I think.
Well, he was one of the biggest road acts. I mean,
but this, the structure of his bits and just how thoughtful everything is, like, I think, and the through line for everything, I just think, again, I think he's one of the smartest comics. He, you know, I don't think he gets enough credit because of Tosh.0, but and how silly that was, but I think he's one of the best comics. So I got to go out with him. Like, I certainly didn't, like I said, my Hodgman experience was fantastic, but so I wouldn't want to, like, you know. And plus, no one's really missing me doing stand-up, I don't think. You ever hear that Doug Stanhope joke about, like, well, it's just like an observation about stand-up comedy. It's the only thing where people just show up for comedy, not knowing who the act is. Like, I had 50% of the people coming out for me, and then another 50% of the people were just showing up.
Yeah.
And
just kind of hoping that it lands. That's always so funny about... if people show up and they didn't know what they were going to see, and they're like, yeah, I don't know, I didn't really, like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, because comedy is not just one thing, you know, like, and I think people always think of it as one thing. I wouldn't say it has as many subgenres as music, but it has quite a lot of subgenres and is unique as the many voices that populate the landscape of stand-up comedy. But it is kind of funny that people are, you know, like, oh, I didn't really, yeah, because you have a certain thing that you like, and this, you didn't know what this was, and it didn't meet the expectations that you had. As you know, it's like if you went to see a band and you're like, I really like country music, but I didn't like this jazz band. Like, oh yeah, well, you didn't like jazz. Like, I don't, what do you,
yeah.
Of course, that's, no one's wrong. It was just a weird match. That's all.
What, now that I look back, one of the worst parts about me on the road also is that I worked in a company, my parents' family business was managing other small businesses. So now I go out to like a comedy club and I'm like walking in like Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse going, okay, bartender Steven. Like, She's pouring drinks for her friends. It's just like I was the worst out there. I just didn't like being away from my family. And that was actually the hardest part about being on the Daily Show. It's like I went to my so when I got that gig, I remember going to my son and I just got the kids into a new school. So they were like 6 and 9 years old. And I'm like, hey, daddy's got a job in New York. It's going to be pretty exciting. What do you think about everybody going to New York? And they're like, okay, well, what if you go?
So is that what you did? You just kind of went back and forth.
It was just a disaster. Yeah.
It was just, gosh.
That's why, like, I mean, my body was just shaped like an airplane seat. I was like flying back and forth like every 10, 11, 12 days, and it, running out of the studio, getting on a train because you couldn't take a cab to JFK. And when I did, I would lay like $80 on the dashboard. And I go, if you make it to JFK in this traffic, all this money is yours. On top of your fare, $80 tip, because I just watch a guy just like double seatbelt as the guy just weaves in and out.
Cannonball Run. You turned into Cannonball Run, basically.
Yeah, an airport run got turned into Cannonball Run.
Every half hour we fall behind, I'm going to take another 20. So you turn into a game show. You totally turn into a game show.
It was crazy just being away. That's what I realized. It's like just being away from the kids. And that's the best part, especially like, you know, your old dad, you're going to be around.
Oh, I've written bits about it already. I don't know when I'm going to perform them, but believe me, I've got the digital page of granddad dad bits. Yeah, I've got them. Yeah. I also don't know if I, and again, I don't want to disparage anyone who posts all the time or who's chasing a dream or whatever. I feel like it just isn't necessarily where I'm at, and sounds like it's not necessarily where you're at. And also, like, I don't know, like, I want to be present for the child and not have her watch me like chasing it, you know, like, I don't know. I don't want her to think that external validation means everything, you know? It's like, oh, that at all costs.
Yeah, and I don't want to be on my phone when somebody's kicking a soccer goal, you know, or, you know, I want to be as present as I possibly can. I hate my phone. I want to get rid of it. I really do. I delete Instagram constantly. To the point, I think it just stopped letting me in. It just loaded so slowly. Cause I'll delete it. I'll look at it, catch up, check out, you know, if there's any mentions or something like once a week, and then I'll just delete it. And then I'll bring it back. Cause I don't have the willpower to like, I'll find myself just mindlessly scrolling like most of us. And I can't do it. I don't have the self-control. So I delete it. And it's not like I'm posting constantly. So just, I'll get rid of it. Twitter, the same thing. I think Twitter is just so evil. Like I can't.
But I think it's designed. Yeah, I think it also, you know, I think we do it because we're trying to distract ourselves from sitting with our own ambient thoughts or whatever. But I think it creates more ambient thoughts. So then we go on it again to distract. Like it's this weird distraction loop that's created. It's addictive. Like it's created to be addictive. And it is. I'm not sure that even the healthiest person in the world, I think, would be like, fuck, this is really getting to, you know, it's like even just that amount of data, trying to squish it in your brain is stressful. Like even if you're not looking at stressful, you could be just looking at puppy posts, and it's still that much stimuli is probably stressful on the brain.
Yeah, I'm deleting everything. I'm just deleting. I haven't had a Twitter app on my phone forever, so I have to actually go through and log in, you know, on a desktop to sort of check it out. And then same thing with Instagram. But I deleted news apps. Like, I don't want to look at anything. I'm too, like, I have too much other stuff going on. Like, I just don't want to, again, get so distracted by it. And I use sleep apps at night. Do you use a sleep app?
Oh, yeah. Like, just like little, you know, like the relaxing, because there's a, I use them. I'll do like playlists on Spotify, like sleep playlists. And it's like kind of guide you.
I use the one that's Sleep Cycle. And it actually monitors your breathing. But the worst part about it for me is that since I'm using that and I'll use Waze and everything, it still says that, like, at the end of the week, like, your screen time was used your phone for 90% of the day. Like, ah!
No! Are your kids into social media at all, or is their generation not super into it?
We've got, all right, so I think my son is in, like, they're still using Snapchat.
Okay.
I can't even begin to understand, like, maintaining status on Snapchat. And that's when it really started, like, the divide. Like, I felt like I was on top of everything. I know how Twitter
Agreed.
Works, Instagram works. I know how Facebook works. I could not tell you how Snapchat works. And then TikTok I get more than Snapchat. But they're sort of like in, you know, they watch TikTok. And they look at Snapchat, and I think they're maintaining their status with Snapchat. That's really what it is. It's like you have a certain number of snaps that you have to do.
Yeah.
With your presence there.
Oh my God, that's so fucked up. Because, I mean, when we were growing up, you'd, of course, you know, to them it's the same content. Like, oh, well, we watched, you know, Gilligan's Island reruns or whatever and over again. But I wasn't encouraged to then make a Gilligan's Island episode. You know what I mean? Like, we were just passive consumers. This idea of being active participants is a whole other level.
You got to check in. You got to, like, constantly check in with your Snapchat, or else you completely lose your status.
Oh God, that's so messed up. Oh, that's,
I think,
so insidious.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that's how it works. But, you know, we always tied it to grades. That's another thing, is like, you get a phone when you turn in a 4.0, gets you a phone. So, you know, getting us there, and they were the last, so, you know, they got phones. They were the end, the last group of their friends to actually get phones. You know, it wasn't too early. It wasn't the ones that are giving 9-year-olds phones. We weren't, you know, the people that were holding on till they got to high school.
And they weren't like, fuck you, you have all our friends and you're not doing this. Were they pretty cool and understanding about it?
There's no, my wife doesn't take any shit. My wife is a first grade teacher who became this educational therapist. So,
oh, wow.
She doesn't mess around. And she's like, my wife's half, who I think you met, she was hanging out with Lorenzo. She's half Korean, no talking back with her at all. And then same with me, you know, I probably let the kids get away with more than she does.
I ask these questions as research too, because it's like, yeah. How do you, because we are in very privileged positions as performers with degrees of success, and we want the best for our kids. How do you make them happy without spoiling them, or without having them take stuff for granted, or not, or recognizing that it's, you know, I don't know, like,
it's tricky.
Create an awareness of appreciation.
It's gonna be super tricky for you. Like, it's gonna be, because we moved our kids out of LA, so we're on in the suburbs around it, just to try to give them like a normal upbringing, and would send them to, you know, when you're going to these super fancy schools and around, you know, super successful Hollywood people, I think that has an element of keeping up with the Joneses for these kids too. You know, they're seeing Steve Carell's kids get a new BMW or a Porsche or something, and they're going to want the same thing. And it's hard not to spoil them when you have the resources. So it's just tricky. I just think in Los Angeles, and especially Hollywood, kids grow up too quickly, you know, so you don't have that weird, dorky, awkward stage, you know, they're just...
I hate to say it, but I've also just the things that are prioritized, and I used to really look down, like, I don't want to LA shame. LA is a wonderful city, and it's so big, you can have so many different experiences in Los Angeles, and that's, the vastness of it is kind of one of the things that's cool about it, But because of this, because of the business, because of, you're right, it's the business itself is prioritized. It's just it's a popularity contest, and it's a business of appearances, like you said. And so yes, that you're growing up in a distortion field, like right there. So I always thought, like, I'll stay in LA forever. But now with a kid coming, I'm like, I don't know if this is the healthiest place to raise a child. Maybe we'll go somewhere else where there are different industries and not.
Yeah, it's going to be this is the main different one. Industry. Same problem. Like, yeah, these lumber kids are really
they think the wood just falls onto the ground by itself, yep, and shaves off its own bark. You know, they don't get it.
Yeah, it's tricky. No matter what, you just have to, you know, it's, anybody can be a parent. Being a great parent is tricky, you know, requires a tremendous amount of work. So, yeah.
And being checked in, you know, like just being checked in. I really hope, I'm sure that even if you had the most detailed plan about this is how I want to be the perfect parent, you probably have to be flexible because you just never know. Like, you can't predict anything. So you kind of have to have a structure, but be flexible and pay attention and check in and, you know, but
yeah, there's a lot to it. So certainly when you are in it, you should definitely hit me up because I have advice for everything. I mean, people are calling me constantly about house stuff or, you know, it's just like homeowner things, but also parenting, school choices, you know, and my wife is familiar with every single parenting style, is, you know, and so she can sort of guide somebody and, you know, whether your kid, you know, how hard to push them in school and how hard, you know, it's just, I tell my kids all the time, like in my school, like I am on my high school's notable alumni and I was easily one of the worst students. I go, just find something you like and try hard and be nice and everything's going to fall into place. Like, don't worry about it. My daughter's stressing out right now about finals. And it's like, it's fine. Don't worry. Just try hard.
Yeah, just do your best. It doesn't have to mean everything, you know. It just when we were growing up, there was so much focus on, like, you study hard, you have to get into a, you know, you go to college, you know, you major in something practical, and it's like, well, now I sort of feel like, you know, if you want to do that, you know, you can, but it also doesn't mean everything, you know. There are pros and cons of doing it that way or not doing it that way. There's a lot of resources available to learn things if you didn't want to do that, you know. It's like the world is just different than it was 30 years ago, you know. So
I still think there's a tremendous amount of pressure on kids to, like, overachieve. I mean, that you'll see. Yeah, I feel like you'll see.
You got no idea.
you don't know. But sure. No, it's like my daughter has, I believe, like, because she took a class in the summer, she's like a 4.1 and she feels like she's fucking up.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And she's,
so she got the like the AP credits or whatever.
Yeah, so she already has taken honors classes that freshmen weren't supposed to be able to take, but she tested into a higher math. And so girls, like, to get into UCLA right now, you need like a 4.7.
Oh my God.
To get in any UC school is sort of impossible. So they're putting pressure on themselves because they see all these other kids just completely overachieving. And that's the idea with, you know, when we started out with Lorenzo in the podcast club. He had to have something like that to get into college. So he needed to be a founder of something. You know, you need to start a charity. We looked at this one kid's resume that he was graduating with, and he had a 4.7. He was on varsity football 4 years in a row. And he had a patent. He had raised money. He'd raised over a couple $1 million for charity in 4 years. I think because he had access to, you know, like a lot of deep pockets, and he was a wealthy kid. But you're going up against that kid to try to
get. I can't even wrap my head around 4.7. Like, that didn't exist when I was in school. There was no such thing. There was no such thing as 4.7. That wasn't, that's almost, to me, that's almost like saying, well, now 100% is not the highest percentage. Now 112. It's like, yeah, but how can anything be more than 100? I don't understand. Like, it's, I can't even compute that.
Yeah, that was always this, at the Daily Show. It's like the story of Dreamer kids. Like, they were always, Florida was always trying to deport, like, the valedictorian who had, like, a 4.9. Or it's like the best possible kid was always a dreamer that was potentially getting deported. And so there's a story like that every single year where, you know, some kid has a 4.9 grade point average and they're trying to kick him out.
My God. Well, I really hope, I mean, obviously, you know, kids discover whatever is important to them at some point. I mean, the way you did, the way I did, you know, my parents noticed that I like comedy. They didn't push me into it. They fed it. But I feel like I just want to be able to notice what are you into, but try to do what you're doing, which is just to say like, hey, you know, you don't, this doesn't mean everything, but I also don't want to, but then the other side of that is like, well, if it's important to them, you also don't want to, you know, undercut it. But I don't know. It just sounds like with parenting, there are obviously some big do's and don'ts, but there's just a lot of like degrees of, well, this is an outcome and that's an outcome. And if you're too much this, then that could lead to that. But if you're too much that, then this could lead to, so you just kind of got to, everyone's just got to do their best and be checked in.
I was doing research for a show that I'm trying to write right now. And I stumbled across this Australian show called Parental Guidance. And I think it's in its first year and it has 10 different parenting types. And it is outrageous. People should look this up, or you should post, Katie, if you want to post a link to this somewhere. It is insane. It is these people watching, they do all these different experiments. So they have French parenting, attachment parenting, they have tiger parents, they have all these different parenting styles watching each other. And they set up an actor to approach their children in the park and try to lure them away.
Like Jesus Christ.
It was heavy. I teared up because I just couldn't imagine my kids in this situation. And it, the actors were really good at it. They're like, hey, my dog just is Charlie. He just had puppies. Do you want to go see the puppies?
And so they're trying to see like how the kids respond to, based on the parenting types.
Only kids that went with the guy, the strict parents.
Oh, my God. That's really interesting.
Because they are taught to respect adult authority no matter what.
And, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was insane.
Is this a whole series?
We were just looking up, you know, I was trying to research something else and stumbled across it. And I guess this is a whole show because you can't watch the full show because we're not in Australia, but they posted a bunch of like 10 minute clips.
Oh, gotcha.
You can watch it, 10 minute clips of this.
Geo-blocked.
Yeah, totally. I got
you. Another reason why you got to go to Australia. So you're going to go watch this whole series and then your son will understand Arge's local references.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's Brisbane bits.
I just sort of branching off parenting for a sec. I want to make sure that we cover the fact that you are really having quite a successful acting career.
Thanks, man.
My wife and I loved seeing you on the physical.
Oh yes, thank you. That was you know, Rory Scovel is one of my good buddies.
You were both terrific. I love it when people discover that comedians can actually make fantastic, like, dramatic actors. And the show obviously has a comedic element, but it is a heavy drama too. And you're great. You were great on it.
No, I mean the way back, that Ben Affleck movie was one of the first dramas I got to really even audition for. So I'm not even getting those auditions. And then when you do, it's really fun to sink your teeth into that stuff. And have those emotional moments. You know, it's pretty cool. And then I've got Morbius coming out.
That's pretty rad. I mean, you know, it's just a big tentpole comic book movie, whatever.
That was another nuts. Like, getting cast for that. Was just, hey guys, telling your family they want me to be in London on Saturday because you don't get like too much time to plan. So this is a Spider-Man spinoff. They're gonna try to do Sinister Six at some point. I'm going to go to London, guys. My wife is such a champ. She's that old, you know, stand-up wife who's like, okay, yeah, yeah, I got it.
It'd be funny if, again, you're like, hey, what do you guys think about going to London? What do you think about you going to London?
We'll stay here. You bring home the money.
And was that, did you shoot that during pandemic?
No, that was shot pre-pandemic. This thing was supposed to come out a year ago or year and a half. I mean,
oh, they just, they kept pushing it because people weren't going to movie theaters.
Yeah. So it was supposed to come out in 2020, July 31st of 2020.
Well, I just looked up the trailer that got posted in a few weeks ago and it's got like 12 million views.
It's pretty cool. This director, Daniel Espinosa, is amazing. I feel like I've gotten to see chunks of it. I haven't seen the full movie, but it looks pretty great.
Yeah. You haven't seen the whole movie, you said?
I've not seen the whole movie. No, I was supposed to go to a screening and I think they had to move it, but hopefully.
That's exciting. You get to watch it just as a fan. You just get to go in and watch it just as a guy who would go see that movie anyway.
And the cat's out of the bag, like they put Michael Keaton in the trailer. But at one point I was in a scene with Jared Leto and Michael Keaton. And I'm like, and I walked up to Michael Keaton and I'm like, I'm not even going to pretend to be cool around you. I go, favorite actor by far. And he really is, like, he's my favorite actor. I saw Gung Ho in the theater.
I remember that movie. Yeah, that's amazing. He seems pretty cool. Like, he probably was
shit. And he goes, I know who you are. He goes, Armenian baby, right? And I go, you're quoting my bit from 2004. I go, this might be the best. It was really the best moment ever.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
So he was in the audience when I had one of the craziest sets ever. I was at the Comedy Store right when Chappelle got back from Africa. And so he goes to Africa after Chappelle's show, comes back. His first show in LA, I did a guest set at. And it was Bruce Willis, Eddie Murphy, Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, like Leonardo DiCaprio.
You got two Batman there.
I know. It was nuts. Oh, dude, I couldn't even look at Eddie Murphy. So I just did a 7-minute guest set, and that's where he saw it. So it was cool shit. But anyway, Morbius, and then this comic book, Primo's. Have you hung out with Axel Alonso before?
Do
you
know? I may have. I'm not sure. I certainly know who he is, but I don't know if we've actually hung out. I'm sorry.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. We're doing this podcast in New York, and I look over, he's got a picture of his son playing basketball. I go, your son plays basketball? My son plays basketball. And then he takes his jacket off. He's got a San Francisco, it says San Francisco t-shirt. And I go, you're from San Francisco? I went to SI, St. Ignatius. And he goes, I went to St. Ignatius. And then we're on the podcast talking about how I always loved side characters, because that was where the only place where you got diversity. If I'm watching Super Friends, I was waiting for Apache Chief to come on, or Cheetah, somebody like I loved any sort of diverse character. He goes, because I'm half Mexican. He goes, did you say you're half Mexican? I'm half Mexican. So we realized we had both had Korean wives, both were half Mexicans from San Francisco, went to the same high school, had sons the exact same age that loved basketball, who met and were the exact same kid. And so at the time, I had no idea he was the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, come to Marvel, hang out. So he gave me a stack of stuff to read. And then we started talking about the complete lack of Latino superheroes. And like, they just don't exist. It's Blue Beetle. It was like White Tiger. And Miss America Chavez, and who's not even, she's an alien. And there's no Latino superheroes at all. So we set out to fix that and created our own superheroes.
That's fantastic. And was did you have an idea kind of going into it? Was there something in the back of your head, or did it just sort of come out was there an ideation process?
Well, it's really funny. I had an idea that he shot down immediately because I go, and this is right at the time I said, all right, Captain America is not the first guy that got injected with that serum. I go, you know, there was a Mexican guy or a black guy that jumped out the window and went running home to Mexico or something like that. And so what if I did Captain Mexico? And I go, he goes, you're going to get sued immediately. And it's a funny idea, but it's something that I've already actually done. Because he, you know, Axel was a pioneer when it came to, like, he's Miles Morales is because of Axel. And so he actually, She-Hulk, you know, he did all of the diversity that Marvel has. I think a lot of it comes from Axel. So, and I think he took a tremendous amount of shit for it. But he said, you can't do that, but think about something else. And then I just stumbled upon this Kanik Janab Pakal, who is this Mayan emperor who ruled from 603 to 683. And they've been looking for his tomb ever since, but they only found it in 1952 because it was puzzle on the wall. And that's where sort of fiction takes off. And they didn't find his body because he had been in space for centuries. So Mayans actually did go to space. And then they came back and they see that they're, you know, people have disbanded. They sort of are able to look through time with this new technology they acquired in space and see that, you know, everyone, pollution has sort of taken over the area and the kids are locked in cages and conquistadors came towards the end and, you know, pillaged the land. And so one of the brothers gets pissed and says, I'm going to take out Spain. They're going to pay for what they've done. And the other brother, Janab, is like, well, hold on. And we came up with an amazing story where Janab really activates the Earth's protectors, these descendants of this Pakal family line that are descended from the first mother, which is another thing that they thought to be true. And so, we came up with our Avengers.
I mean, this is a movie I want to see now, too.
Oh, it really is cool because I don't think you've seen anything like it before because everything has to do with their family tree. So it's almost like they can access this Mayan cerebro and they see that, oh, this kid that they find in South LA, that's a skateboarder that just took, you know, drugs at a party is the world's most powerful shaman. And he is in a line of shamans that's the infinite number of firstborns. So his mother was a firstborn, something that he'd have no idea, but right. He, from the first mother, was in a first. And that's what gives him this power. And so all he needs is an artifact to really, and he's been having weird dreams the entire time. So we have him, a Mexico City cop, and this El Paso sort of border freedom fighter that's in a difficult spot when we find her. And they have to stop their evil uncle, and that's their origin story. So it's really like Primos Assemble, and then we sort of get them set up from there. So I'm excited how this like sort of continues, and then there's an infinite number of possibilities. So we set up our super villain, and you know, they're...
Oh man, this sounds amazing. And oh, also it... We're just in the age now where, I mean, when you and I were growing up, like, there was not a lot of superhero stuff. And then the stuff that there was kind of cheesy. And then obviously, you know, Tim Burton's Batman came along, Michael Keaton, and then kind of elevated the genre a bit. And it still took another, I don't know, let's say 10 or 11 years before I think special effects and technology got us to a place where we could have X-Men and Sam Raimi Spider-Man and whatnot. But when you're making a comic like this and you're talking to Axel, are you guys saying, like, do you think of it as a cinematic experience also? Like, are you thinking of it as that kind of like, oh, and if it's a movie, then this kind of opens up this? Or are you strictly thinking about it as just, like, let's just focus on making it a comic now and we'll think about all that other stuff later?
We're doing four issues, so we really wrap it up. And I think it's just great because that's how I got into comics was a limited series. Like I found it would comic stores when I was like 13, 14 were, and they probably still are, like they're so intimidating. Everything's intimidating when you're a 13-year-old. But I walked into this comic book store and I remember seeing West Coast Avengers 1 of 4. And so we're doing this 1 of 4, I mean, like a four part, it's 4 books that'll add up to the graphic novel, but you can't help but think in terms of movie, and like this is the perfect sort of origin story. It just, it does lend itself to a movie pretty darn well, like the beginning and the end.
And so how does it work? Like you release the limited series, do they see how it does and then go, okay, let's do another chapter of this. Let's do another series. Let's do other characters. Or
I mean, actually we've already decided to do more. So that's a great thing about working with a small publisher like this is that it doesn't really, it's not dependent on the success. And we've already sort of talked about what the next installment of this thing looks like. So it's going to be released in English and in Spanish, and we're definitely going to keep making more of them. It's super fun. The artist is Carlo Barberi, who did Deadpool, and like,
oh, wow,
this guy is like the best partner ever. Who, you know, we were talking, and he gets occasionally he'll get two guys fight, and he'll have to draw that, and then he gets incredible detail on what the people want in the scene. And I tried to split the difference a little bit and really learned how to do this from Elliot Kalin. And then Paul Scheer was very nice and sent me a script that a long time ago and something that, you know, how he outlines. And so I'm really sort of just copying, you know, stuff that Axel and Paul Scheer sent me a long time ago.
Yeah, but, you know, it's... we set out on our paths again, as I said earlier, we, you know, maybe it's stand up and, you know, it's interesting to see where that leads. But then this idea that you had, because you connected with someone and you recognize that there is a severe lack of representation in this area. So you go, I want to do something that's meaningful. And it, again, you are making this amazing thing because you looked inward to look outward, as opposed to just looking outward and going, well, how famous of a comedian can I get? You know, oh, I recognize that when I was growing up, there was almost zero representation. It, you know, it's not much better now. I want to do something about that. And then you lay out what just sounds like this fucking amazing. I mean, everything you said just sounds fucking awesome. And it really came from this authentic place to want to make the world better. But then on top of that, to make like a cool thing to do that, like what more could, I don't know. When we think about our careers, it's like, what else could you want? Like, that's exactly, yeah, you're doing exactly honestly, what you want to do.
Yeah, it is. Like, that's what I mentioned, like having, being able to be in Morbius, write this comic, be able to like, you know, guest star on Physical and hang out with Rory for a bunch of days and like do that. It really is incredibly rewarding. And then there is something magical that happens, as you know, when you sit down to write, that when it just all comes together and you have that big aha moment. We started thinking about, because I'm doing this, you know, I'm working on this with a guy named Felipe Flores, who's a very talented artist. But when I came up with the idea for the genetics of it all, because we started thinking about the seventh son of a seventh son. Mm-hmm. There was a movie called The Seventh Son,
which, yeah,
I suppose you say, and the powers that sort of go along with that. It really is cool. Like, okay, you're in an infinite number of firsts, but look at all the different ways that this can, these powers, good and bad, have been allocated throughout. It really is like this Mayan 23andMe that they have access to. And like, oh, well, this combination, we need to definitely watch out for these guys. So I'm thinking in future installments of this, they can start to track down their other primos and realize that, you know, there's some bad primos out there as well. And everybody has, you know, certainly has different powers. And we know who all these people are because we can track them through this, you know, we're developing that right now, is this Mayan calendar that you can sort of, turn and locate people. If you're a you know, the fourth son of a fourth son, you're going to have this different, you know, power and ability. So,
I mean, is your career kind of like, when you look at it, you look at all the cool stuff you're doing and have gotten to do, does it line up with what you thought you'd be doing? Or is it just like,
I always thought I'd do stand up 100% of the time. I didn't even know I was going to act. I didn't know that acting was even a possibility.
Not as common when we started out. Now, I know that a lot of comedians, you know, the sort of, a lot of comedians used to do stand-up. I mean, used to do sitcoms, like in the 80s and 90s. But this thing of, like, comedians doing dramatic, like, being able to get pulled into dramatic roles and stuff is still in the... In the lifespan of television as a medium is still, and film as a medium is still relatively new. Like within, I would say the last like 10 or 12, 15 years, maybe.
When I watch what Ray Romano is doing as an actor.
Oh, he's fucking amazing.
Amazing. Incredible. Like, I just like, that's what I wanted to be. Like, that is amazing. It's just, it's so cool. And Michael Keaton was a stand-up comic. And like, there's so, comics are really able to do quite a bit, you know, and they do, you know, a lot of people drop off and join writers' rooms, and a lot of them drop off and become actors. But to remain a pure stand-up, it's just, there's a lot of perseverance and sacrifice that I just, you know, again, don't think I have.
I do get it now. I always used to think like, God, why did they stop? They were so funny. Why did they stop? Why'd they stop doing stand-up? And now I'm like, oh, right. Because we are not fucking Wolverine, and you get tired.
It's not just even me being tired. I think people are tired. Like, I was in London while I was doing Morbius. I got to go out. There's a really cool comedy club called Top Secret. There's a Bill Murray Theater. There's a comedy store there that's more of a tourist place. But this Top Secret, I'm on stage, and I'm in their upstairs room doing a bit about succulents. And I looked into the eyes of a 22-year-old, and I'm like, yeah, I'm good. I'll wrap this up. Like, I'm not going to do this succulent bit for a 22-year-old. Doesn't even know what it is. Like, I'm like, who's buying succulents? You can just break one off, put it in the dirt. You see one?
Hey, guys, horticulture. Am I right? Huh? Anybody? Horticulture? No. Okay. All right.
Well, that was the old George Carlin thing. Is like he got so wealthy and so like that. He's and I'm not saying I'm like super wealthy or anything, but I was like, he stopped going to the post office. He stopped going to the supermarket, and he stopped like doing all that to, you know, going all the places that
he did not have the everyman's point of view anymore.
Not anymore. And so that's when like I'm doing bits about what I know, which are now succulents, and you know. Repainting my house with these hardwood floors. It's just, I'm all like totally focused on renovating my house, and that's it. You know, and then gardening. I'd rather be gardening.
Just never forget though that farts are really funny. Everyone does it, no matter what age you are. And so you could always just fall back on that. You could just do a whole. You could go back to that theater and then just do all farts all the time, whether you're 22 or 122, it's going to land.
And with the exception, remember when we were at the improv, when we'd look over at the bar, at the end of the bar, and there'd be old comics hanging out, and it was a little bit sad, and it was cool, and then it wasn't so cool anymore, and I was like, oh, that guy's awesome. Oh, that guy's here every night, huh?
Yeah, because it is a lifestyle, like the nonstop, like the road dogs, you know, like it is a lifestyle. And I think it is probably for people who have difficulty sitting still. And so they just constantly need to be in the machine. And that is fine for them. But it is. But that's it. But again, it's just a different path. And it just doesn't. And I just don't know. I would kind of lament sometimes like, I wish I was more known for my stand-up, because I think of myself as a comedian, and my wife would go, yeah, but you don't just do that. You get to do, like you said, you get to do so many things. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I get to do a lot of fun stuff. What the fuck am I, why would I want to do what I would have to do to get that. I don't think I would want it.
Stand-up should be called, or the little byline would be, Al and Chris try to make peace with the fact that they don't do stand-up anymore.
They're just too exhausted to... they're just too over trying to hustle to get butts and seats, and so they're just like, who needs it? These grapes were sour. I could smell it from here. It just... nobody...
Rather than do a 9:45 spot at the Comedy Store, I would much rather be on my couch watching Below Deck Mediterranean with my wife and daughter heckling Captain Sandy. You know what I mean? Like, so much more fun.
You know, maybe as you and I are becoming the Statler and Waldorf of this grand performance Muppet show, it makes me wonder if their origin story is that they were young performers, Statler and Waldorf, and at certain points they were just fucking over it, and now they're bitter, but also they're not, it's not that they're bitter per se, but then there's also a lot of like, ah, you fucking idiots. You just dancing your hearts out up there. Fuck you. You know, like that's maybe part of their origin story.
There was another thing that I actually got to do. And I think this was during the pandemic. This had to be during the pandemic or right before. I got to do a bit with Beaker.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah. And I got to do Muppet, like a Muppet sketch. And again, thanks to stand-up. Stand-up gets you in. And yeah, it opens a lot of other weird doors that we can go down. So
it's a good skill set to have. Like it's because it is not, I think people underestimate what it takes to do it. And it's not just like, oh, this guy, yeah, Jack in my office, he's really funny. He should do stand up. Like, well, Jack's probably gonna have a hard time with it because it's not just cracking jokes for, you know, your office full of friends. There is a structure to it and it is grueling and you have to really embrace the process.
Now here's some dad advice. I never want you to ever forget.
Mm-hmm.
Never host the school auction.
Oh, Al's a comedian. He should host the auction.
No, thank you. It really is a bunch of drunk parents who can't stop talking. It's the worst crowd ever.
Well, I think for a show to work, the audience kind of has to want to be there. And maybe there's some school functions that not all the parents are, you know, super engaged and want to be a part of the festivities.
I got roped into being the announcer for my daughter's volleyball games, and I've had nothing but complaints.
This is the parenting advice that the books won't tell you about. This is just good, practical. Don't do this. I swear on everything that I will never forget that you said that. And if it ever comes up, I'm just going to say no.
Got asked to do the auction and gala for my daughter's high school. And the lady, I said, I'd love to, but I go, I'm an insult comedian. And I swear a lot. And I go, it won't go well.
So maybe we'll just not, it's better just
that
to bow
out. And you know, that's not true. I would be professional with it. But that got rid of her immediately. They never called again.
That was that. That's great. You essentially blacklisted yourself.
I blacklisted myself.
You go, here, I'm going to hand you the black pen to write in the book to never call me for this.
Yeah, I swear a ton, and I tell off color jokes.
I'm very rude on stage. I just don't think it's a good fit for everyone. And then guess what? You're going to get blamed because you asked me to do it. So
maybe even fired. It'll go so far. Might get terminated making this call.
That's where they just somehow manage to digitally tear up your number.
Yep.
And then just never call you again.
Well, I'm excited for the baby. That is just so cool. Do you know, have you said if it is it a boy or a girl? Do we know?
The girl. It's a girl. She'll be here in 7 weeks if all goes according to plan.
Let me tell you the thing that, do you remember the old Native American comic that was Charlie Hill? Who he found out I was having a daughter.
Yeah.
And he told me that he had three daughters and said a daughter is from the age of 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 going to be the best friend that you've ever had in your entire lifetime. It's the best date. You'll love no one more. That relationship will be just unbreakable. And there's a reason why he left out 12. But he's very right. And everyone I tell that that's had a daughter comes back to me and says, you know, they remember me saying that because it's very true. Like 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, dude, it's going to be fantastic. So
we're so excited about it. And it's something that we wanted to do, and we put it off because of the pandemic. And so we were very fortunate that it's actually happening now. And so, I don't know. And I'm also glad that I'm at a point where I don't feel so career obsessed anymore, where I sort of feel like, oh, this is actually a really good time, because we're excited. And also just like the kind of, it's stressful in the sense of like, God, I want to do a good job. I don't want to mess it up, but it's also exciting because it just sort of feels like, oh, just endless possibilities, you know, so many things and so many, you know, like, oh, I'll show you this movie and I'll bet you'll love this game and this Lego set and you'll like this, you know, it's like, we probably, you know, like you can see, like we have like Disney shit already in our house. So, you know, like it's, we're just both like over the moon about it.
Matching family pajamas. You can do that.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen. My wife will do it. Like a bunch of matching pajamas will show up, like, and there'll probably be ones for every day of the week, you know, and I'll probably grumble about it. But then afterwards, like, all right, that was actually pretty fun. All right, I'm sorry I grumbled about it.
I did it because my son, it was just me and my son when he was little. He got such a kick out of it. He loved it so much. And it was like, oh, just on the off the look on your face alone, I will wear whatever you want. Let's do it.
Well, I'm so happy for your success and all these amazing, fun, cool things you're doing. And please tell Lorenzo I said hello. I hope.
Well, I'd like to hear that.
I hope to see you soon. I'll text you.
Congratulations. It's really the best thing that's ever happened to me is the kids. So you're going to love it. It's been so fun.
We are very excited about it. And we'll have you over soon. And I'll text you in like 30 seconds.
All right. Later.
Recording stopped.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.